I have this little herb garden on my patio. It is not much, a box with some thyme, cilantro, tarragon, mint, and lemon balm. So on a sunny day, I put this all in, and it was beautiful and green, and I took a picture, and I put it on Facebook, very proud of myself, and my friends kind of freaked out. Mint has a type A personality, one of them said. Put it in its own pot. Another said, and I quote, lemon balm is a totalitarian dictator. I am learning. Both went into their own little pots, and I think I have prevented outright chaos. But the point is, invasive plants can quickly take over ecosystems, whether that's a planter box or an entire state. We will hear what local plant nurseries are doing about that this week on the Up North Lowdown from Interlaken Public Radio. I'm Ed Ronco. We'll also hear from the Stories That Heal project a little later in the episode. But we are indeed starting in the garden, because invasive plants are actually a pretty serious issue here in northern Michigan. And with gardening season now in full swing, plant nurseries are bursting with new flowers, shrubs, trees, all to bring home. And some of the most popular plants are actually invasive. Despite that, they are still legal for sale here in Michigan. So, what's a plant seller to do? IPR environment reporter Ellie Katz explains.
Anna Oler is standing under a wooden pergola full of hanging baskets for sale when she sees one basket that shouldn't be there.
Actually, take this one out. This has Creeping Jenny in it.
She pulls the basket down and points to a plant called Creeping Jenny.
This is Creeping Jenny.
So you won't sell this one?
No.
Oler co-owns Bright Lane Gardens, a plant nursery in Lake Ann. And Creeping Jenny is a plant they've committed not to sell.
And what we're going to do, there's a special way to dispose of it, because if I were to just dump this in the woods, it would literally take off.
Creeping Jenny is a green vine that looks nice and spreads fast, but it's also invasive. Despite that, it's still sold and distributed in Michigan. Bright Lane Gardens supplier accidentally put the plant in an order during a busy spring season. Oler decided to keep it and throw the basket away instead of sending it back.
We bought it fair and square. We accepted it. So this one's on me. We take the loss on it and we'll dispose of it appropriately. But that's not one that we'll sell.
It is beautiful.
It's beautiful. It's beautiful. It grows well. I mean, I totally understand why people love it. I really do.
Many popular decorative plants are not native to Michigan, like hydrangeas, daffodils, or Japanese maples. But those species don't really cause harm to the environment. Invasive species spread like crazy beyond just the bounds of the garden and do cause harm to the environment. And a lot of the time, the qualities that make these plants problematic also makes them attractive to gardeners. Take Creeping Jenny. It's used as ground cover because it spreads quickly, creating thick green mats. It's hardy and can produce bright flowers. Shelley Stusick is with the Northwest Michigan Invasive Species Network.
When we think about, oh, they have perfect leaves, like nothing's eating my plants. Yeah, because they didn't co-evolve with our native fauna and pollinators, so they don't really recognize them as food in the same way that they do our native plants.
And Stusick says a lot of the time, they're perfectly legal to buy and sell.
I think there's a conception for, business owners and just the general community that if a plant was invasive, that the state would regulate it. They just assume that would happen and that would happen immediately.
But that's not always the case. State agencies say the regulation process takes a long time. Stusick says many popular invasive garden plants degrade habitat. They can choke out native plants and the pollinators and animals that rely on them. So the Northwest Michigan Invasive Species Network has tried solving the problem another way, through a program called Go Beyond Beauty.
For Go Beyond Beauty, we have our top 14 invasive ornamental plant species. And these are the 14 species that are still kind of actively for sale that participants of the Go Beyond Beauty program have committed to not use or sell.
The program asks gardeners, nursery owners, and landscapers not to buy or sell these plants. And in return, participants receive recognition online and in their stores or gardens.
that's why Go Beyond Beauty exists, to celebrate those people making that decision, especially business owners who are potentially cutting into their bottom line by not selling certain plants, you know, that are popular.
Sussex says there's a lot of demand for the program. Go Beyond Beauty started in 4 Northwest Michigan counties and is now expanding statewide. Anna Oler at Brightlane Gardens is part of it. And she says the commitment to not sell certain invasives has gotten her more interested in native plants.
Let me take you into the native plant hoop house, actually.
When she and her husband first opened Brightlane Gardens 5 years ago, she says they unknowingly sold a few invasive plants. Now, they have an entire hoop house dedicated just to native plants. But she says selling them can be challenging.
And as you can see, there's only one thing that has a flower on it, and that is this coreopsis over here.
Oler picks up the coreopsis, a bushy plant with yellow flowers. She says it's one of a handful of native plants they sell that blooms this early in the season. Other native plants don't get flowers until later in the summer, and they aren't grown in a heated hoop house that causes them to bloom artificially early. That can be a tough sell for customers looking for plants with big, showy blossoms as soon as gardening picks up in April and May.
So from a native plant perspective, it's harder to sell these. All you can see is a little bit of green above the soil. It's hard to understand what they'll look like as mature plants, which is why we've invested so much time in our educational brochures and signage and online resources to really show people, like, this is what the mature plant will look like. You just have to commit a couple years to it.
Oler has created YouTube videos and store signage to educate customers, and she says it's made a difference. That native plant with the yellow flowers called coreopsis, Oler says they've carried it for several seasons, but it was never really a hot seller.
Once we told people it was native and talked about some of the benefits that it could have for the soil, for the environment, for the birds and the insects, they sold like hotcakes. Like, this is our last one left. We ordered probably 40 of them for opening weekend, so we just sold through all of them.
As she puts it, people go crazy over the native plants. And as the word gets out, she only expects that demand to grow.
Ellie Katz reporting. One more thing on native plants from our very own Cheryl Bartz. Lately, she has been sharing outdoor adventures with us. And this weekend, we are going with her to a secret spot.
Okay, there's nobody in sight, so I'm heading off the trail up a little hill between rows of an old red pine plantation. There's the first one. The first pink lady slipper of the year. Okay, standing right here, I can see 1, 2, 3, 6 beautiful mature lady slipper flowers. Up here in northern Michigan, a lot of people have a secret spot. Could be a favorite fishing hole, a place to pick morels. But for me, this is my special spot where the pink lady slippers grow. I don't tell people where it is. Maybe an occasional friend, somebody I know who will watch where they plant their hooves or won't try to dig one up and take it home because it won't survive. And I especially like to share it with friends who have a really poor sense of direction so they can never find their way here again.
IPR's Cheryl Bartz with What's Up Outdoors. She brings us that every Sunday morning on Interlochen Public Radio during Weekend Edition. We'll be right back.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
On October 15, 1900, the Burt Lake Band of Ottawa and Chippewa Indians were burned off their land in northern Michigan. It was the start of a long struggle for survival and justice.
Our main job is to establish reaffirmation. That's what keeps up the fighting spirit, because it's always there. And that's kind of part of what makes you Burt Lake, is that you're working towards that.
After nearly 125 years of waiting, will the Burt Lake Band finally get the federal recognition they've been after? That's next time on Points North. That episode of Points North is available now. You can find it wherever you're hearing this podcast.
Welcome back to The Lowdown. Before we tell you some more stories, we want to talk about something that happened here at IPR this week. We learned that our Points North podcast was the winner of four regional Edward R. Murrow Awards. Not for nothing, it's the second year in a row that Points North has done that. Michael Livingston's story of Joyce Fetro, who used rock hunting as a way to recover from addiction, won for excellence in writing. An episode by Ellie Katz about freshwater jellyfish took home honors for feature reporting. And Dan Juan Shura claimed two awards, one for his story of a harrowing ice rescue on Saginaw Bay, the other for his profile of Kenny Pheasant, who teaches his native language, Anishinaabemowin, in order to keep it alive and healthy. You can find those episodes and every episode of Points North at pointsnorthpodcast.org or through the app you might be using to listen to this podcast. The Edward R. Murrow Awards are given out by a broadcast journalism organization called RTDNA. That's the Radio, Television, Digital News Association. And just one more note here. Every episode of Points North undergoes multiple edits and meticulous work. And at the center of that is editor Morgan Springer. Now, her name is not on these awards, but her talent certainly is. Congratulations to our colleagues here at IPR and at other Michigan news outlets who also took home awards this week. For a couple years now, Interlaken Public Radio has been part of something called Stories That Heal. It's a workshop that focuses on heartache, loss, mental health, and helping people use music to work through those experiences and tell their story. Right now, we'll hear from Diana Priest in Benzie County, who went to sleep one night and woke up more than a week later to a very different life. Here's Max Howard with her story.
If you ask Diana what her life is like, what it's defined by, she'll give you a blunt and simple answer. Loss.
That's the way my life is. It's all about loss. I shouldn't be laughing, but I'm nervous.
In 2020, Diana went to bed and woke up missing a leg. A blood clot had formed in her leg and put her into a coma for a week and a half.
And I woke up and the first thing my husband said to me was, they had to take your leg. I said, okay. And that was it. I don't know, when somebody asks me how I am, you know, I say, oh, I'm okay. People don't want to hear when you're not okay. So you always say I am.
In a Stories That Heal workshop, Diana was paired up with Toby LaCroix and Addison Page, songwriters from Interlaken Arts Academy. They wrote a song called Phantom Pain, and there's a number of ways that metaphor explains Diana's life.
The first verse has to do with my leg. Phantom pain is having a pain where you're not hurt, but it hurts. And it's been 4 years. But the doctors told me I may feel it forever. You feel it all the time. And you just have to learn how to deal with it.
Diana has had a lot of loss in her life. But at the workshop, she was retelling the story about her leg and laughing with the students.
Well, and I used to work in a nursing home, so I dealt with death.
Yeah.
And he even sat with people while they were dying, because you don't want them to die alone.
Yeah. Whoa. Hold on. Yeah, I feel like this could either be a very specific zone, so like we talk about like
A moment,
like losing your leg, like using like the words around losing a leg, or we could just make it very vague.
Very vague.
Well, as I already said, my husband died in July, and I still haven't really cried about it.
Wait, like last year, July?
Yeah, just last July.
For the first few years after she lost her leg, her husband Thomas was her primary caretaker.
I think it was kind of lonely for me. I mean, he could get up and go up to his mom's or go wherever he wanted to. Mm-hmm. But if he didn't want to go, which a lot of times he didn't because he wanted to watch TV, we just stayed at home. I couldn't just take off and go anywhere. So, and then he got to where he was watching TV upstairs, so I was sitting by myself most of the time, watching the other TV.
While we talked, she started recounting the recent deaths in her life. 6 family and friends in the last year.
None of these people died all at once. It was like at least a month in between, maybe 2. My husband was the last one, the last death. His stomach was very extended, but the rest of him was like skin and bones. And I knew there was something wrong with him. He knew there was something wrong with him. He just wouldn't go to the doctor. So then finally, one day, he was sitting on the couch and he couldn't get up. So he finally called the ambulance. I didn't have to. He did it. And then when he got up to the hospital, they told him he had the colon cancer and there was nothing they could do. It had advanced that far. And what it was the mass was so big down at the end of the colon that no solids could get through. But then he pretty much stopped eating. He was proud of himself. He finally quit smoking. It's because he ran out of cigarettes and couldn't go get any more.
Since Diana lost her leg, she had grown more and more to depend on him.
Well, because I always depended on my husband to do these things. And then when he kept getting sicker and sicker and not going to the doctor, it's like, he's not going to be around forever. I've got to be able to do these things myself.
Thomas had been diagnosed with colon cancer in June 2023. And died a month later, just 3 years after Diana lost her leg.
When I meet a new person, I just listen. I don't really talk, but like I feel like that's different right now because I cannot stop talking.
That must mean she likes me.
I think so.
Part of Diana's story is her joy and her resilience. After her husband passed away, she couldn't rely on him to drive her places, so she started taking the bus. First, it was to doctor's appointments, but then slowly, it turned into taking the bus to the senior center to do puzzles and sew buttons onto mittens for charity. Then it turned into taking the bus to see her sister, and then to weekly dinners at the Laughing Horse Saloon with friends.
The Laughing Horse, I've never been there before. Is it good?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, well, it must be because it's your favorite place. So what do you like about it?
Well, it's big enough for the whole group. There's like 18 to 20 of us.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
It's a big group. It's a big posse you guys got.
Because even going through school, I was always shy, and I never belonged in any cliques or groups or anything.
Yeah.
But now I feel like I do.
You see, I think you might have more friends than me. You know, I'm 31 years old, and you've got me beat. And there's so much loss, but then, like, you're taking the bus here. You're seeing your friends. You're going to the gathering place.
Yeah.
You're putting the buttons on the mittens, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And putting puzzles together.
Do you think I'm seeing that correctly? Is that kind of like a story of your life, of becoming, like, self-reliant and, like, having the people
this is
come
a happy in. Ending to the story. Yes.
Is it a happy ending? I don't know. I mean, this is kind of what I'm seeing.
I think so.
That story comes to us from Max Howard. Diana Priest participated in Stories That Heal, a workshop that brings together people who have a story to tell and songwriters who help them tell it. She and other participants had their songs shared at the Garden Theater in Frankfurt recently. Learn more at iprnews.org. All right, let's find out what else went on this week in Michigan. Initial construction began for the Fish Pass Project in Traverse City. The first of its kind project, which replaces the Union Street Dam, will use recognition technology to sort different fish. It lets desirable species make it upstream while blocking invasive species. The project was delayed by a lawsuit, but ultimately allowed to move forward last fall. This is part of years of restoration work along the Boardman-Ottaway River. Residents near Grayling gathered to tell state and National Guard officials to hurry up on their efforts to address PFAS contamination. The toxic forever chemicals move through watersheds without breaking down, and they are linked to an array of health problems, including cancer. Camp Grayling, a National Guard training facility, became one of the first PFAS-contaminated sites identified in Michigan in 2016. Officials say they have enough signatures to apply for a $25.6 million grant from the Michigan Department of Environment, Great Lakes, and Energy to get homes on private wells at risk of contamination connected to the municipal water supply. Governor Gretchen Whitmer has signed legislation that closes insurance loopholes on mental health and substance abuse treatment. Those loopholes previously blocked patients from treatment, but the new law treats mental health and substance use disorder in the same way as physical health care, removing a number of barriers. Public school teacher salaries in Michigan have declined when accounting for inflation. That's according to a study from Michigan State University. Inflation-adjusted teacher salaries slid more than 20% since 1999. That is the second biggest slide in the country. A public opinion poll that went along with the survey says more than three-quarters of Michiganders support increases for starting teacher pay. That's it for the lowdown. We had contributions this week from Ellie Katz, Cheryl Bartz, and Max Howard. I'm Ed Ronco. Our producer is Max Copeland, and we get our music from Blue Dot Sessions. We'll leave you now with our sonic send-off, music from a different source. It is graduation season for high school students, and we are on the campus of Interlochen Center for the Arts, which this week will graduate its senior class of 2024 from the Interlochen Arts Academy. And yeah, we could play Pomp and Circumstance, but something cool happens here before graduation, and we want you to listen to that instead. The students at this boarding school for the arts get to showcase the things they've been working on all year, maybe in some cases all 4 years, film, theater, dance, visual art, and certainly music. So here's a little taste of the Interlochen Arts Academy Jazz Orchestra showing what they can do on the eve of graduation ceremonies. Thanks for listening, and have a great week.
This week, we explore the joyful soundtrack to tropical exploration game Chia, which combines voices, folk instruments, orchestra, and ambient natural sounds in a musical celebration of the culture of the South Pacific Islands of New Caledonia. I'm Keith Brown. Join me for the music of Chia on Gameplay.
You can stream full episodes of Gameplay on demand and view playlists at gameplayshow.org.